I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. We've been Disney fans our entire lives. And now, as childless adults, we're undertaking a journey through the media that shaped our lives.
Trying to find out if what made them special is still there.
We are Rewatching the Magic.
Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Tuesday.
Hey, it's another episode that we're doing this time. This time we are doing Disney's Hercules. Bless my soul. Oh, boy. Guess before we start all of that, check us out on iTunes. Check us out on Spotify if you haven't already. Eventually, we're going to have to re-record that outro with this stuff in it, but neither one of us has time right now. We barely have time to do this show.
Yeah, we decided to start a podcast, and then we suddenly both got very busy. That was ill timing on our part.
Also, once again, our friends over at MarsCon, definitely check them out. We'll put the ad again right in a minute here. But please go to, if you haven't already, go to MarsConDementia.com and purchase the fundraiser album. All the money raised on that fundraiser is going towards the convention to pay for hotel rooms and stuff like that. And we really want to help our friends out. So here is the ad, and we'll be right back.
The longest-running live comedy music concert series is almost here!
Everything about this is dumb and so am I. Here we go.
MarsCon is happening February 28th through March 1st at the Hilton Minneapolis St. Paul Mall of America. Featuring the world-famous Dementia track with performances by Great Luke Ski, Devo Spice, TD's Kyle and Lynn Zilla, Mikey Mason, Mark with a C, Beth Kinderman and the player characters, Cornflake, Brett Glass, Carl Brown, Michael William Hunter, Il Neige, and this year's music guest of honor, Lauren Mayer.
Mom's menopausal with a teen in puberty, not a pretty sight to see. Around here no one talks when we can yell, cause we're in hormone.
Plus, Dementia Water Aerobics and Merch at Table 27, Dementia SmackDown Wrestling, and more! Be sure to pick up your copy of the MarsCon 2020 Dementia Track Fundraiser MP3 album with over 4 hours of live music and comedy recorded at MarsCon 2019 for just $20. Visit MarsConDementia.com and click on Shop.
I'm so happy the way that song came out, and I'm absolutely shocked that we put it together in a week and a half.
Registration for a weekend badge is $55 until January 31st, after which the price goes up to $70 at the door. For more info on MarsCon, visit MarsCon.org. Thanks for listening, funny music fans, and
we will see you at MarsCon 2020. Peace.
Woo! Audience, leave.
And we're back.
You know, I really like the guy who does the voice for that commercial. He should be a voice actor.
He should.
Yeah. Speaking of voice actors.
Yeah.
There's a segue. We got a lot of them in this movie.
A lot of them.
Because it's an animated movie, and there's always voice actors in animated movies. But, you know, credit where credit is due, I guess.
Yeah. But it's, you know, it's Disney Renaissance movies, so you're going to have a lot of celebrities in there as well. That's just how it is at this point with Disney.
This, even more so than the ones we've talked about before, this is the one that they really went full in on stunt casting. Yeah. This is stunt casting the Disney movie.
This is also pop culture the Disney movie.
Oh, yeah.
They kind of started it with the Genie and Aladdin, and it seems more and more movies got more and more pop culture references. This is... every character is doing a pop culture reference. The entire, you know, all of the visuals, all the jokes are all pop culture-y in some way, to a point where at the time when this movie came out, I was kind of groaning at it. Like, really? They're doing a little too much. But on the rewatch, it's like, it's kind of a time capsule of that time of Disney, I guess.
And honestly, because of the way that animation works, especially Disney animation, where it takes so long, so many of the references were already dated by the time the movie came out, but watching it now, it's just absolutely excruciating in some parts.
Yeah.
Like, the whole Air Herc thing.
Yeah.
I honestly, because I don't follow fashion in that sense, but I don't even know if Air Jordans are really, like, still a thing.
They are. Jordans are very much still a thing. Jordan doesn't okay. play anymore. And like the new Jordan, I hear constantly from my coworkers that are several years younger than me about how the new Jordans came out. It's like, even then.
Okay, that's how out of touch I am. That's showing my age. But I was like, is that even still a thing? But, yeah.
They're not really called Air Jordans. They're just called Jordans. But, you know, it's like, Air Jordan made sense because Michael Jordan, he played basketball, jumping. That works. Air Herc, he doesn't really jump. Unless it would be Air Pegasus, if it made sense that way.
Yeah.
But that was just because of the pop culture reference.
Yeah, and so many of them are shoehorned in kind of like that, where it doesn't quite make sense, but they really desperately wanted to reference a thing. Yeah. I mean, in Aladdin, it was all Robin Williams, and you could forgive it within the context of the film because the genie is, you know, there's theories that the genie kind of has this omniscience and he kind of sees all points in time at once or something. There's also the theory that Agrabah is actually a post-apocalyptic Earth that has rebuilt after a post-apocalypse.
The only characters who should be doing pop culture references in this movie is the Fates.
Yeah, the Fates, I would have absolutely, but they don't really do any of the pop culture references.
Outside of indoor plumbing.
Yeah, the indoor plumbing joke is really the only, but that's not pop culture, that's just like things that exist in the future.
Yeah.
So yeah, the only characters that should be doing this are the ones that don't. Pretty much everybody else gets some kind of, yeah.
So how this movie got started, it pretty much got started as an adaptation of Homer's Odyssey. That's how, that's through my research. And then they ultimately decided that the character of Homer was not relatable. So they decided to go into the direction of adapting the story of Hercules, which is probably be a better option, honestly.
Yeah, because demigods are so much more relatable than a completely mortal human king.
I mean, they could have done Sinbad. I think it would have been much better.
Yeah, honestly, I could have found Disney's Sinbad as being an interesting story.
But knowing Disney, they would have casted Sinbad as Sinbad.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't think they would have been able to stop themselves, especially not in the mid-90s. Yeah.
So, Hercules. They really, Disney tried to pull a lot of stops out for making this movie in terms of the premiere of this movie. They premiered this movie in New York City at the New Amsterdam Theater, which Disney recently purchased at that time. They still own it. Currently, it is the home of the Aladdin stage musical. So they did this whole weekend about it. They even brought up the Disneyland Main Street Electrical Parade to New York City, created two new floats for it featuring the characters of Hercules, and called it the Hercules Electrical Parade. You can actually find the footage of this on YouTube. They even did it as a TV special. And the parade actually goes down 42nd Street, just like it does in Disneyland. They even have the Disney, Disney actually ends up getting all of the stores around down 42nd Street to turn their lights off, just like it does in Disneyland. All but one does, which was a Warner Brothers store, for obvious reasons. Yeah. And so they do this big thing, you know, they own the theater, you know, they own the, do this, they do a lot of stuff to kind of make the Hercules premiere a big thing, but it was supposed to be bigger, and you mentioned that right before we recorded. Do you mind going into that story?
Yeah, one of the things, since this was based on the Greek mythology and set in Greece, Disney really wanted to do a big premiere, an open air premiere on the hill, mountain, whatever, in the center of Athens. And they had, you know, started all of the thing for it. And I guess this would have had to have been after the American premiere. Because of the time it takes to redub and everything, get the rights overseas at the time. There's not as much delay now, but in the 90s, you know, there typically was a delay. So I'm guessing that that probably happened here. In any case, the Greek media kind of got a hold of what the story of Disney's Hercules was going to be like, and the tone that they had taken with it, and they absolutely savaged Disney in the Greek press, and public opinion turned against it dramatically in Greece, and Disney was accused of being yet another foreigner coming to steal Greek culture and distort, you know, their legends and myths and history and whatever. And basically, like, the entire country of Greece was like, you know, this is a really grubby cash grab. So, no. And it turns out the Greek government basically shut the whole thing down and refused to let them have their big premiere, because it's, you know, an important cultural and historical site in Greece and everything, so the government kind of has control over that, and they refused Disney access, basically on the grounds that this movie made light of Greek culture and Greek myth and traditional Greek religion, I guess.
Yeah, and the character of Hercules was not foreign to the American pop culture at the time.
Definitely not at that time, no.
Because there was a certain television show that was airing at the time that was very popular, that was about Hercules, and as closely as you could in daytime television, network television, getting close to the myth as it was in the original mythology written. And that would be Hercules, The Legendary Journey, starring Kevin Sorbo. Oh boy, we're already starting on this one.
Yeah.
I like Xena better.
Yeah, I think everybody liked Xena better. The thing about that, though, was that there was a very kind of, I'm not saying it was everywhere in pop culture at the time, but there was a weird kind of Greek Renaissance going on in America at the time, at least in Greek mythology. Things is that you had a lot of films and TV shows delve into Greek myths at the time. For some reason, the 90s just hit, and part of that I think was Hercules' Legendary Journeys. But it was by far not the only player in that game.
Yeah.
So there were several competing Greek myth media entries at the time. This just happened to be the one done by Disney aimed at kids.
And because of this film happening, Universal, who owned the Hercules Legendary Journeys and Xena, they did their own animated movie just to compete, called Hercules and Xena: The Battle for Mount Olympus.
I saw at the time, yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, hey, if Disney can make some animated money off this, we're going to make some money off this too. Get a cartoon out there. And so it was kind of in stores around the same time that Hercules was getting in stores on VHS. So in a very, trying to find a asylum way, like the asylum would. You know, you would get your mockbusters that transmorphers or something like that.
Yeah, and in very, I was gonna say, like, in a very similar kind of asylum style, video stores at the time would kind of stock those two things together.
Yeah.
Hoping that parents would be like, no, they still do have a copy of Hercules, and just pick up the wrong one.
Yeah.
Don't know why, but apparently a lot of people did that in video stores, and I never understood that, because I don't think I ever walked out of a video store with a movie I didn't intend to rent.
A lot of animation studios did that at the time. They were doing different versions of fairy tales. Oh, their own version of Snow White, Pinocchio, their own version of Beauty and the Beast, even Hunchback of Notre Dame, Pocahontas even.
Yeah,
put them in the video stores and say, okay, you couldn't get the Disney version, but we have this version. And
yeah, if you were a kid in the 90s and you had a parent who didn't really pay attention that much to cover art on boxes, you probably got a lot of knockoff animation at that time being brought home. I feel for your childhood. I knew many of my friends had that complaint.
I did too. I had a couple of those bootlegs. My parents didn't really care. Like, oh, it's a cartoon. It doesn't really matter. Like, no, this is not the version that everyone's talking about. Well, whatever.
I think my father was a bit too OCD or whatever about it to not, like, he wanted to make sure he was getting the thing he paid for. So
many animation studios got smart and started putting their movies in the clamshell packaging that Disney was already using at the time.
Yeah, that is a thing we've never actually talked about, because we kind of deal with the films themselves rather than a lot of the external stuff. But that Disney clamshell packaging will snap you back to your childhood in a heartbeat.
Today, if you go to a Disney store, you will see products shaped like the clamshell VHS cases. And it's like, you know, here's a, you know, Little Mermaid purse, but it's shaped like the clamshell VHS box. You know?
Yeah. And I'm not sure we can really overstate how much of a nostalgia trip that is for people our age.
Yeah.
Because that was your, like, half your video shelf as a kid, I'm sure.
You can't really duplicate that with Blu-ray and DVD boxes, you know? Can't really have that same kind of connection.
Yeah, that is kind of sad. And I still have some of those clamshells, you know, VHSs hanging around. I couldn't really tear myself away from them last time I did a purge. They may go one day, but not today.
So I think that's all we could talk about the non-movie portion here.
I do have one other thing. We were talking about how badly Grease took this as a slap to its culture. The interesting thing is because there was that kind of renewed interest in Greek mythology in the U.S. at the time, my friends and I, all being nerds, had gotten really into classical Greek and Greek mythology. And we hated this film when it came out. I mean, I remember us just sitting, I was in high school at the time, but I remember us sitting at lunch and just savaging this film. One time, a group of friends and I had a teacher who needed to be out sick, and as they did, I don't know if they still do this in public schools, but in the 80s and 90s, if your teacher was out sick, they would just have a substitute teacher pop in a movie on VHS that's somehow vaguely related to the class.
Yeah.
And so I forget what class we were watching this in. It might have been choir, and they were like, it's a musical, listen to music or whatever. But I remember that the entire class just sat around for the entire movie just talking about how absolutely unrealistic and unfactual it was. And I thought about it today because we talked about Pocahontas last week, but I remember us hating the liberties taken with Hercules more than we hated the liberties taken with Pocahontas.
Hmm.
And if that doesn't tell you everything you need to know about American culture, right there in a nutshell. I don't think I had thought about it, of course, at the time, and I haven't really thought about it since, but thinking about it today, I was like, Pocahontas, for at least my personal friend group, it was released, and we were like, wow, that wasn't very historically accurate, and we moved on with our lives. We spent years mocking this film. We absolutely hated this thing. So, I don't know. I just find it interesting that, you know, mess with a real-life woman who, you know, had a tragic life and we kind of shrugged and moved on, but mess with a figure from Greek mythology and we got angry because Kevin Sorbo did it better or something. I don't know. It was very
this really, really, really wasn't a Hercules movie. This was Superman.
This was absolutely Superman, which is interesting because if you know anything about the creation of Superman, Superman was partially based off the myth of Hercules anyway.
Yeah.
So it is kind of full circle. But this, I do agree with you. This felt so much like Disney desperately trying to do a Superman movie.
I've been looking up and saying this was Disney's first attempt at a superhero movie. And I can actually understand that. You know, this is straight up, you know, whether you want to talk about Superman or Goku or whatever. You can even put some of the story of Jesus Christ in here and see some similarities.
Yeah, but honestly, the Jesus comparison can pretty much be done to almost any demigod from any, you know, religious or mythological tradition in history. So, you know, you can do that with Egyptian mythology as well, just as easily. So, I don't really think they were kind of harping on that as much as I think they were harping on the Superman. Of course, as many people, Zack Snyder, would point out, there are a lot of allegories between Superman and Jesus as well. So,
yeah. Release the Eisner cut.
Or, you know, don't. Just don't bother. I don't think we really need it.
All right.
No, Disney would do that. I'm sure if an Eisner cut existed, Disney would not hold it back. Disney would absolutely, if they thought they could make five more bucks off this thing.
Yeah. So anyway, we were talking about this before we recorded. They actually spun this up into a TV show.
Yeah,
the Hercules animated series.
The TV show was, for my opinion, more entertaining in general than the film. I really liked what they did with it, and I can't wait. You know, we're planning on talking about it at some point in the future.
Yeah.
But if you want to know. If you want to have, like, a really good time watching a Disney cartoon, go watch that one. It's highly underrated, in my opinion.
They actually add more myth. One of the main characters is Icarus.
Yeah, they really kind of paid more attention to Greek myths in the TV show, I think, than the movie did.
The TV show actually takes place in the middle of this movie. Like,
yeah.
You have the Aladdin series, which takes place after the movie. The Little Mermaid series takes place before the movie. This is slap dab in the middle of the Danny DeVito singing.
Yeah, this is right in the middle of the training montage, yeah.
Yeah, which is very unique in a way that they could, although it leads to some continuity errors as the series go on, but I don't think anyone really cares.
Yeah, I don't think it's a priority for anybody, really.
Especially because since Hades is not supposed to know Hercules is alive at this point.
Yeah.
But whatever, we are getting ahead of ourselves.
Very.
Let's rewind this thing here. Let's get back to the beginning of the movie here. Music by Alan Menken and David Zippel. Okay, we don't really know much about the guy. I mean, he has a career.
Yeah, but usually this would be where I would go off on some long rant about, you know, this guy was a Broadway veteran and he was I'm sorry, but, you know, all apologies to Mr. Zippel, but, you've had a really boring career, sir. outside of his work for Disney, he has done things that were nominated. He did the musical based on Neil Simon's The Goodbye Girl. He did a musical comedy called City of Angels. None of the stuff... he did do Liza's at the Palace, which if you're a Liza Minnelli fan, you know, that is kind of a big feather in his cap. But he's not...
He's no Stephen Schwartz.
He's not, you know, where we could talk about Stephen Schwartz or anything, this was not, you know, he is not up there with them as far as that.
He's Leopold Bloom.
He very much is. And we kind of mean that in the kindest way. But it seems like right now he's doing more behind-the-scenes work as opposed to lyric work, and it seems his most recent credit was he was producer of Spamilton, an American Parody, which was a off-Broadway parody show of Hamilton.
Family, I assume.
I don't think so. I think just Hamilton. I think they just needed
a... Looking at his Wikipedia page, he's a lawyer. He had a lifelong love of musical theater. This guy is Leo Bloom from The Producers.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you are correct. I kind of skipped over the biography there.
His most recent thing is he actually is working, or has worked, on a stage adaptation of this movie.
All right. Well,
that'll be. I guess that's the next Disney stage production. I think the most recent one they did was Frozen, and we talked about Hunchback. Aladdin is still playing. Lion King is still playing. I don't know if Hercules is going to be the next big Tony Award-winning musical, but we'll see.
Oh, well, here's an interesting footnote that I missed doing my research earlier. Mm-hmm. He also wrote the lyrics to a more recent Disney-owned property.
Hmm.
In Captain America, the First Avenger, there is a song, The Star-Spangled Man. He wrote the lyrics to The Star-Spangled Man with the plan.
Hey.
So, okay, there you, my opinion of you just raised a little bit, because that was an awesome... Stuff. Yeah, that was a catchy little tune. So, all right, we'll give you that one, Mr. Zipple. But there we go.
I think that's all we can say about that.
Yep.
So let's get to the movie. Modern Disney logo, not the classic, which I'm very surprised this movie gets that.
But again, our theory has been that they only keep the classic logo when the song starts over the logo, and this one did not.
Okay.
It starts with the opening narration. So I think that's why we got the new CGI logo tacked at the beginning there.
And yeah, we do have our epic narration done by Charlton Heston, Ben-Hur himself, which makes sense. Say what you will about Charlton Heston.
Yeah. I could, but I won't.
Yeah, yeah.
But it does start this movie off making you think it's going to go a completely different direction.
If they had stayed in this direction, I think it would have been a more stand-the-test-of-time kind of movie. Like, you can, for example, you can watch Ben-Hur today, and it'll still look good, and the story can still be followed, and you don't really get any kind of, too much cringe.
Yeah.
But then...
Yeah, they make you think it's gonna go in, like, a Clash of the Titans or a Jason and the Argonauts kind of thing.
And I guarantee the only reason they got Charlton Heston was because he was in Ben-Hur.
Oh, yeah.
Give you that. And then, well, ancient Greece. Gods, heroes, the mighty Hercules. Great narration, epic narration, interrupted by our actual narrators, the Muses.
Yeah, and interesting to start out in a museum as well.
Yes.
you know, that the opening that you see is just a collection in a museum until we get to the urn that has the images of the muses on it.
Willis White, Cheryl Freeman, LaShanze, Roz Ryan, and Vanessa Y. Thomas provide the voices of the muses, and we'll be hearing them a lot in this movie.
Yeah, they do show up a lot, and I like the idea of using the Greek chorus in Hercules.
Yeah.
I am a classical theater nerd, you know, I did my, you know, my minor for my undergrad years was in theater, and I studied a lot of classical Greek theater and performed in some of it. But I love the idea of using the Greek chorus theatrical idea. And I like the idea that it is the muses.
Mm-hmm.
Because the muses don't get enough respect as characters on their own. I don't think they're very distinct here. You can't...
Apparently they do have names, but they're never said in the movie.
They do. I mean, the muses always had their own specific name. I mean, they are their own characters within Greek mythology. You know, they do have their own personalities and their own individual spheres, but they never get talked about in this movie. And honestly, if you were just to show me an image of them and be like, you know, which one's Melpomene, which one's Terpsichore, I don't, you know, yeah. I wouldn't know.
And they never give you any kind of indication which one is which. They're just the muses.
Yeah.
Except for the one that really, really had to think for Hercules.
Yeah.
Girl, you mean Hunkules.
Yeah.
Charlton Heston saying "You go, girl" is the most 90s moment.
Oh,
right,
yeah.
At the beginning of this movie.
I cringed so hard because I'll be honest, I have not seen this movie since high school. You know, so it's been like a good 20 years since I've seen this. I had forgotten about 80% of this movie entirely. If you had asked me the plot to this a week ago, I could have only given you the barest sketch.
Yeah.
But running into that on the rewatch just physically made my body recoil.
Like, you know that meme everyone shares of Steve Buscemi saying, "How you doing, fellow kids?" That's this.
Yeah, this is Hello, Fellow Kids, the movie. It really is, and it is, but it is just that cringy in some places.
Yeah, so, and it's also gets us to this aesthetic that we have of the music, which is very, very, very gospel. We kind of joked about it last week, is like this movie about a Greek hero, Greek legend, Greek mythology with gospel music, which, now that I think about it, makes a bit more sense because it is about gods and gospel music is about God. I can understand that. It just, when I first heard this stuff, it just felt so out of place.
Well, the interesting thing to me was that this movie is aggressively white. It really is. Almost all of the characters are not only portrayed as white in the film, but done by white actors, with the exception of the muses. And it's fascinating to me that they decided to go with several styles that were connected with not only American styles, because the music in this is very American. Like, for The Lion King, they tried to bring in African rhythms, African instruments, African choruses, the language. There is none of that in Hercules. This is a very American style, but it is a African-American style. It is Black America style.
Yeah.
It is gospel music.
It's rock.
It is kind
doo-wop.
Of...
There's an entire song
doo-wop,
that's just
doo-wop. Yeah. There's an entire doo-wop number. Even the kind of go the distance, even though it's done by Michael Bolton at the end of the film for the pop version, that kind of style was very much thought of with black male singers in the 90s. That was the typical style you would get in, you know, that was the Peebo Bryson style.
Yeah.
In the 90s.
Seal, almost.
Seal, you know, there's you really did connect it with black male artists, that particular style at the time. I think it's broadened since then, but listening to this when it first came out, everything about the musical choices in this is taking heavily from black American culture. Mm-hmm. So
let's get to that first song, The Gospel Truth. As the Muses tells us of long ago, that the Titans terrorized the earth until Zeus used his lightning and trapped them away. This movie needs an epilepsy warning. There's that one scene in The Gospel Truth, you know what I'm talking about? This movie needs an epilepsy warning. Doesn't have one. Needs one.
Yeah, I don't know exactly if it's bad enough, but if you do have any sort of photosensitivity, rethink it and maybe have somebody skip you past that part of the movie, because I did notice that as well, that there are flashing images at the beginning there that are kind of bad, so I'm not sure if that would be a problem for anybody, but you may want to be warned.
Anyway, Mount Olympus, not long after the defeat of the Titans, Zeus, voiced by Rip Torn, and Hera, voiced by Samantha Eggar, welcome their new son Hercules into the world, and this is like the big change. The first big change of the mythology of having Hera and Zeus just be happy married couple with their little baby boy Hercules.
Yeah. Also, I'm going to say, since we've already seen the Titans, the way they chose to portray the Titans was very weird. The Titans were really just the parents of the pantheon of gods that we see. And they are portrayed in most of Greek mythology as being very similarly human to the pantheon of Mount Olympus.
Yeah, and this one, so, they make them look more like their respective elements.
Yeah, they are elementals rather than titans. And there's only like four of them, but the
technically
titans were,
five.
You know, yeah.
Technically there's five titans, but one technically isn't a titan.
Yeah, but
get to him.
But the titans, at least in the myths, were very similar to the gods of Mount Olympus. I don't know why they would be portraying them as anything different, except that they immediately want you to fear them.
Yeah.
So
these are monsters. These are bad guys.
Yeah. And that was not necessarily the Titans in the story. They were just, I mean, you know, they did bad things, but so did all the Greek gods. You know.
So let's go back to this party that Zeus and Hera are having for their boy. All the gods are there, including Hermes, voiced by Paul Schaefer. And they make him look like Paul Schaefer.
Yeah, like we said, pop culture stunt casting the movie.
Missed opportunity, honestly, to have David Letterman play Morpheus.
That would have been cool, yeah. Because, you know, I mean, who else puts you to sleep in the 90s except David Letterman? I think we all fell asleep to David Letterman every single night. I don't mean that in a bad way. I loved David Letterman.
Exactly.
But that was just, you know, that's what you put on when you were going to bed. Especially if you had a TV in your bedroom like I did. That's just, that's your bedtime
watching.
You're in
your bed, you have your snack, you're going to watch Letterman.
Yeah, that's the night.
Especially if you
could
have Paul Schaefer there, you know, Letterman and Schaefer, why not?
Yeah.
Lapis so, gifts, go ahead.
I honestly think Paul Schaefer did fine in this part. Like, just from a voice acting perspective, I think he did what he was there to do.
Schaefer's not really known for being an actor, but
yeah, it's very strange, but he was pretty good in this.
Yeah. He gave Hermes quite a personality in this movie.
Yeah, and Hermes is kind of, I mean, you know, he is the messenger god, and you think of him when you think of, you know, speediness and all that kind of stuff. So the way that they had him kind of zipping around and upbeat and everything, I buy that for Hermes as a reasonable portrayal.
Not a lot of the other gods really get speaking roles in this movie. And if you really didn't know your gods, you wouldn't know which ones they were. Narcissus is not a god.
Yeah. It's weird when they're like, you know, only gods can live on Olympus, and then they've got some people up there that you're like, you may need to rethink your definition of god there.
though Artemis does have a cool moment when she ricochets that lightning bolt.
Yeah, that is pretty cool.
So anyway, Zeus and all the gods give Hercules lavish gifts for his birth. Zeus gives his own gift, the winged horse Pegasus, voiced by Frank Welker.
Frank Welker! He is your childhood. Love him.
We need to have that as a jingle.
Yeah. We need a soundboard of just like random jingles for all our voice actors we love on this show here. But
it's gonna be Frank Welker and Jim Cummings. Frank Welker and Jim Cummings.
Yeah.
Don't worry, Jim Cummings is coming up later in the movie.
It's the Frank Welker and Jim Cummings show. Oh my god, I would watch that show so hard. If you just
I would
Frank
go to
Welker
a convention solely. I would go to a convention solely to have Jim Cummings and Frank Welker on the same panel.
Yeah, just stick the two of those on a panel and let them do whatever they want. I would be there with bells on.
Go ahead.
I loved the thing about Pegasus and the creation of Pegasus, where Zeus is just taking the different types of clouds,
yeah,
and forming them into the winged horse. But I also love. I had just, before I did the rewatch, finished watching a really cool video about a phenomenon called cute aggression. Wisecrack put out this is Disney related, so the Wisecrack channel on YouTube just released a video about Baby Yoda. And why we find things cute, and then also the phenomenon where you're like, oh, that's so cute, I could just squeeze its little head until it popped. You know, it's called cute aggression. That is a response some people have to cuteness. And when I saw Hercules just look at the absolutely adorable baby Pegasus and immediately grab him and headbutt him across the room, I was like, yep, cute aggression. It was just too cute. Baby Hercules could not stand it.
And the two instantly bond over that headbutt.
Yeah,
keep this in mind. This comes up several more times in the film.
Yeah, when I first saw this movie, everything about this opening scene just I hated it because Hera loving Hercules.
I know, right?
Snuggling him and wanting the best for him. And
don't put that lightning bolt in front of the baby.
Yeah, I was like, no, this is not, everything about this is wrong. But I guess, you know, all right, it's Disney and it's for kids and we don't want to have the, like, you know, Zeus went down to Earth and philandered with a woman and left a bunch of illegitimate half-god children all over Greece.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's still, to this day, it just kind of sends, like, weird shivers up my spine to see Hera being like, oh, cute little baby Hercules, I love you so much. Because I'm like, this is a trap, and I'm not sure how. But this can't be right. I can't
hold
trust
the baby's
it.
Head, Zeus, and all that.
Yeah, I don't know. It's so strange.
So let's enter Hades. James Woods.
Oh, James Woods.
Yeah.
Are you like me when that you're like, you look back on your life and you're like, oh, I regret ever being a fan of James Woods now?
Yeah.
Because I was a huge fan of James Woods. He made this movie for me. He was like the only part of the movie I was super into when it first came out. And now you just kind of look back on it and you're like, oh.
Yeah, and the fact he kind of plays Hades more like a used car salesman, it's perfect for this kind of film.
Yeah, I mean, everything about this portrayal within the context of this film is perfect. I mean, you can take issue, and please do, with how it's portrayed between Hades in this film and Hades in the myths, but for the context of this film, this was a brilliant way to go. And also, rewatching this and looking at the animation that they did, you can see what would later become anger in Inside Out.
Yeah.
This was absolutely, I don't care if the animators themselves tell me they weren't thinking of it. The animators were definitely thinking of this when they animated anger for Inside Out. I will accept no other explanation because it's too close. Some of the things there, all of the kind of just, you know, randomly exploding into a mountain of fire and stuff, the way all of that is set up is too close.
Yeah, so, Hades and Zeus don't get along. This is they make this very clear at the beginning of this movie. They kind of act civil in the context of this party, but Hades really doesn't like Zeus. You know, I could just die, oh, if only.
Yeah. I don't think Zeus cares one way or the other. I don't think Zeus has any particular animosity versus Hades. Because Zeus, as portrayed here, is just a happy-go-lucky guy. So I don't really think there's any animosity his way. I think it's an entirely one-sided grudge by Hades.
Yeah, for, you know, giving the job of being the god of the underworld. Kind of doesn't want to do that, but, you know, but what can you do?
Yeah.
So let's go back to the underworld, and we get our glimpse at the three-headed dog Cerberus.
Hey, never boy, named, what a good named, boy.
Never named in the film. Never named in the film. It's sad.
Yeah, that one honestly is just there as like an Easter egg almost for people who actually know Greek myth. Yeah. Like you know why that dog is there. You know why it has three heads. You know what its name is. We're not going to mention it.
And feeds him one steak.
Yeah.
One steak for three heads. It's like feeding one, you know, three, you have a couple of pets and you're feeding them like the one thing. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
And we get the minions, Pain, Bobcat Goldthwait, and Panic, Max Headroom himself, Matt Frewer.
Woohoo!
Who have informed him that the Fates have arrived. Let's talk a little bit about Matt Frewer. I can say that name. I guess I mentioned him, you know, Max Headroom right there. Bobcat Goldthwait, legendary stand-up comedian.
Yeah, and Bobcat Goldthwait was... He was a big name in the 90s at this point, but I feel he had had a little bit of a slump before this movie, and this was a slight comeback for him. He wasn't quite as on top as, like, you know, Robin Williams was, but he was very much a, like, oh, hey, it's Bobcat Goldthwait. Like, you still knew who that was immediately.
At this point, it's more Pauly Shore than Bobcat Goldthwait.
Yeah. But, you know, he was still using that character voice pretty much constantly at the time. He has dropped it since. Because that's not an easy voice to do. Even if you're used to doing it and you trained it, that particular style he had is basically like taking a cheese grater to your vocal cords. So he had to eventually drop it just to retain the ability to speak at all, I think. But at the time, he was still known for that voice, very much in the same style as Gilbert Gottfried was.
Yeah, and like I said, Pauly Shore.
and Pauly Shore.
A lot of comedians just were like the voice. I mean, I would even say if you want to throw in someone more modern, I would say Larry the Cable Guy. Or Pee-wee Herman.
There is a certain class of comedians who their affectation is that one thing. You know, they have like one kind of vocal affectation, and that is their signature. And even I'm not at all selling these people short, because they are all brilliant comedians in their own right. But there was a point in time where having a vocal affectation of some point, some sort, was the I don't want to say the norm, but it was a little more common than it is now. But you still have even more modern comedians, like the dearly departed Mitch Hedberg, mm-hmm. was very known for his kind of weird, drugged out stoner kind of method of speaking. And so, yeah, it was a thing, and it was much more common in the 80s and 90s, I feel, than it is today.
Let's get to the Fates. Amanda Plummer, Carol Shelley, and Patty Edwards play the Fates. And they are shown cutting the thread of the life of a mortal, sending that life to the underworld, into the River Styx. The Fates can also see the future. Indoor plumbing, it's going to be big.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Just want to remind people, because she's not a household name, unless you're like a real deep Disney fan, is of course, Patty Edwards, Flotsam and Jetsam.
Yep.
We've talked about her and her career before. Mm-hmm. Amanda Plummer is one of those amazing character actresses. I know that I remember her most probably from Pulp Fiction is the first thing. Like, when you mention her name to me, her in Pulp Fiction kind of pops up before anything else. So, there's there. I don't think we've... I think this might have been Amanda Plummer's first... foray into Disney. I don't really remember her coming up. And Carol Shelley is mostly a Broadway actor of some note. So she was in the original Broadway cast of Wicked. And she won a Tony for The Elephant Man on stage. So, yeah, she's legit in there, if you want to know who those three were.
All right, so Hades charms the Fates into showing him his future. Yeah, his future. 18 years from now, the planets will align, allowing Hades to free the Titans, take down Zeus, and Hades will rule Olympus until Hercules gets involved and stops it. Hades puts together a plan to kill Hercules so he doesn't interfere by making him mortal using a special potion. So Pain and Panic go to Olympus and kidnap baby Hercules.
Kidnap the Hercules, put him in a... Sorry. That was a different movie.
They only say only gods can go on Olympus. How about Pain and Panic on Olympus?
I don't know. Narcissus is up on Olympus. Maybe it was like we opened it up for other celestial weird supernatural beings. I don't know.
Maybe they use Hades' ID to get into the door.
We're totally Hades. They do have that shape-shifting ability, though. So
yeah, they do.
Maybe they shape-shifted into Hades for the door check there, and then went back.
So this is pretty much, I'm pretty sure, this is the first time a Disney animated couple is shown sleeping in the same bed.
You may be right on that. I honestly can't remember. This is one of the few Disney heroes to ever have two living parents. So I'm not sure that... everybody else gets like one parent tops. Most of them are like, you know, orphans, or they got like, you know, a weird faraway... parent, but Hercules gets four absolutely doting, loving parents. I don't know what's up with that. But yeah, I don't think there was ever really a moment before that you would have had that. Mm-hmm. So you may be right on that. I hesitate to say that you're like 100% correct, but I can't think of one.
Yeah,
right
I can't
now.
Think of one. I'm pretty sure. But anyway, so Pain and Panic kidnap baby Hercules. They have him drink the potion, which removes his immortal glow. But Pain says that the baby must drink every last drop of the potion before they can kill him. And before that can happen, they are interrupted by Amphitryon and Alchemy, Hal Holbrook and... I can talk. Hal Holbrook and Barbara Barry, respectively. I can say those names. Alliteration. go ahead.
It is interesting that they do have both Amphitryon and Alcmene in this at all. I think that's interesting. Alcmene in the Miss was of course Hercules' birth mother, human birth mother, but Amphitryon was her husband and Hercules' the stepfather, I guess, if you want to call him adoptive father. And Hal Holbrook and Barbara Barry are absolute legends in their own right. So well done for the casting. It's small parts. Mm-hmm. But, you know, still. Hal Holbrook, very famous for his Mark Twain one-man show. And then, of course, he really got famous on screen from playing Deep Throat in All the President's Men. And you have seen him in almost everything up until his death. He was still working. Barbara Barry was mostly a television actress. And she was the wife on Barney Miller, which was a detective sitcom in the 70s that was quite popular at the time. But she also had an amazing career, including an extraordinary amount of stage work. So, yeah, both kind of big names here for the adoptive parents of Hercules.
So Pain and Panic try to finish the job before the people can get to them, but they get their butt kicked by an infant. Because he didn't drink the last drop, he still retains the strength of a god. So you have these two little demon people getting their asses kicked by an infant.
You would think that, like, wouldn't the potion remove the strength first and then the immortality later? But no, it's a weird, it's reverse potion day.
Yes.
That's what it is. Immortality first, strength at the very end for reasons unknown.
Yeah, so Pain and Panic have failed, but Hades doesn't need to know that. If he finds out. If it's good.
Yes. I do like if it's good.
So because Hercules is now mortal, the gods cannot retrieve the child and have no choice but to allow him to be raised by the mortals that found him. And all of that was 14 minutes.
Yeah.
14-minute opening number.
We outdid quite a few of our previous films for that.
So long that on the soundtrack it's broken up into three songs.
Yeah, it is. I will say that this was, I believe, the first movie in the Disney Renaissance that I did not own the soundtrack to. For everyone prior to this, I absolutely had to have the soundtrack the second I left the theater. And this one I have never owned the soundtrack to, so make of that what you will.
So let's fast forward. Hercules, teenage Hercules, voiced by Josh Keaton, singing voiced by Roger Bart, Broadway legend himself.
Yeah, Roger Bart.
Yeah, you and I saw Roger Bart in the production of Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, we saw it at the beginning of the U.S. national tour after it finished its first run on Broadway. The original cast, most of them, went on tour, including the two leads, one of which was Roger Bart, playing Dr. Frankenstein.
Frankenstein. He does a killer Gene Wilder impression, I'll tell you what.
Yeah, he was. That was an absolutely incredible show. We were very fortunate to have been able to see it. Roger Bart was absolutely stellar in that. And he's absolutely stellar in this. Mm-hmm. His being able to, I mean, you've got something like Gene Wilder in Young Frankenstein that he can mimic very well. Mm-hmm. And then granted, you know, it was almost 20 years earlier, but being able to do the kind of, aw shucks, Midwestern teen almost. This is so wanting to be Superman that they basically cast Hercules as an aw shucks Midwestern teen.
Yeah.
You really expect him to come off the farm in Kansas and go right to fighting a Hydra or something. It's, I don't know.
And that's pretty much what happens, but Herc, young Herc, is a bit of a klutz. He can't control his own strength. And we see Demetrius, voiced by Wayne Knight, who was the vase seller. He doesn't want any help from him, and none of the kids want to play with him because he's a klutz. And because he's so strong, being a klutz means the entire marketplace collapses.
Yeah, he really destroys that town center.
Yeah, and they see him as a freak, and no one wants to associate with him in any way. And he just, that's the point. You're supposed to feel sorry for him because he's just this outcast, outsider kind of person that no one wants to be around. He feels like he doesn't belong. That he's supposed to be somewhere else, which leads to our "I Want" song, "Go the Distance." Which Michael Bolton did sing at the end of the movie. This was the song that they wanted, that they were going to put all their money on.
Yeah.
There's a different song in this movie I think they should have, but we'll get to that one.
This song, as well as skipping forward a little bit, a small portion of Zero to Hero were the two musical things they used to promote this movie.
Mm-hmm.
All the trailers had some combination of those two songs in them. But for the most part, they really did put almost all their eggs in the basket of "Go the Distance." And I call this song "Go to Sleep." I'm sorry, this song bores me to tears.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the slower songs, and there isn't, and most of the song is telling you the exact same things over and over and over. Like, I don't belong here. I want to be somewhere else. I want to be where I can be myself. And that's the entire song.
But you know what? You can say the exact same thing about "Part of Your World." It is slow. It repeats how much she wants to be in a different place, how much she doesn't belong where she is. All of those same criticisms you could very fairly level at "Part of Your World." One of them is a classic that everybody remembers the words to, and one of them is like, I mean, stop a person on the street, and if they could sing any part of this song, it would just be like, "I will do something, I will go the distance." Like, it's the Five Golden Rings part in 12 Days of Christmas. It's like, you know that one line and nothing else. So, I don't know.
And it's not Roger Barr's fault. He kills this song. It's just,
His vocals on this are amazing. The fault is in the song itself, because I actually was a Michael Bolton fan pretty heavily in the 90s, and even that, when it would come on the radio, I would just be like, snooze, switch channels, let's see what else is on. So I don't know. It just, this song never did it for me. And
you can tell that this is where the Disney Renaissance starts to dive.
Yeah, you linked me to the new cover of this.
I posted it on my Facebook page.
Yeah, that is Matthew Morrison, excuse me.
Yeah.
That is putting out a Disney cover album, it seems, and this is one of the songs in it, and they posted a big flashy music video or whatever on the Disney Vivo. And I absolutely love Matthew Morrison in anything. He's great. His most recent, he was just an American Horror Story, and he was great in there, even though he didn't sing. But I absolutely love Matthew Morrison, and even his version, I made it about halfway through before I had to check out. It just, I cannot deal with this song. I'm sorry.
This song is making good singers bad, I guess.
Yeah, and the thing is, once again, the vocals, all three of those people, Roger Bart and Matthew Morrison and
Michael Bolton,
are excellent singers, and their vocals on the song are very good. Just technically, they are brilliant. The song is just so aggressively boring.
So let's forward here. So we get Ma and Pa and Kent saying goodbye to Clark as he's off to the Fortress of Solitude to learn the answers to where he came from.
Yeah, that's what I got from that scene too. It's like, here's the weird alien artifact that came along with you from your birth, son. Because they do. I mean, they hand him the medal and they're like, this is the sign of the gods or whatever. Why don't you go to the temple and talk to your dead dad? And you know, it's like,
here, Clark, here's the blanket that you came in. Here's this weird symbol on it.
Yeah, I don't think we can stress enough how much this movie wants to be Superman. It really gets very in your face about it as the movie goes on. You start the movie and you're going, without,
this is probably why Warner Brothers didn't want to do anything with Disney.
Yeah, I mean, this is downright plagiarism in points, I'd say. This is just barely copyright-free Superman here.
So, Herc is off to the Temple of Zeus because the medallion he wore as a baby has the symbol of the gods on it. We already said it. So, at the Temple of Zeus, Herc prays, and then a massive statue of Zeus comes to life. Zeus tells Hercules the truth, that he is a god that was turned mortal, but his godhood can be restored if he proves himself a true hero on Earth.
And this is the first the audience hears about this, so, like, where did Zeus get this from? Like,
well, it's been a while. Okay.
The caveat on the potion or whatever? Like, if you use this to remove immortality from a god, they may earn their godhood back, only if they prove themselves to be a true hero.
Well, we don't know. I mean, this is what? He's what, 15 years old at this point? 14? He's teenage age.
Yeah.
So Zeus had 14, 15 years to try to figure out, how do I make my son a god again? And this is probably what he found out.
Yeah.
So Zeus tells Herc to find Philoctetes, the trainer of heroes, and reunites him with Pegasus, and they headbutt again. And that seems to jog Herc's memory. Oh, I remember you from I was a day old.
Well, he was a god, so we don't know how quickly gods age mentally.
True. And together, Herc and Pegasus fly off to start the journey back to where Herc belongs, back to Mount Olympus. Okay, well, that whole... I think we've already said everything we could say about that whole go the distance scene.
Yep.
It's, you know... So let's go to the next one, which is the two make it to a dilapidated island and meet a sailor. A satyr! Not a sailor. I have problems talking today.
He does, however, have the mast of the great ship there. So
he meets a satyr. It's Philoctetes, voiced by Danny DeVito. And he's perving on some nymphs.
Yeah, I was really off put by how much guys perving on women there is in this movie.
We'll
there is a lot. this is kind of the start of it, though. This is the first you see, is that, you know, he's chasing the nymphs and trying to grab them.
Yes.
It's not just that he's, like, flirting with them or trying to talk to them. Like, he is physically chasing them and trying to grab them, and they do not seem to want that. So maybe not a great introduction for your kind of heroic mentor here, Disney. Just a thought.
Definitely, you know, where this ain't the Rocky movies, apparently.
Yeah. And this is the other thing, is they really, really, really wanted him to be Rocky's trainer, you know. Overall, I think Danny DeVito was a good choice for this. And he fits in well with the tone they were going for in the movie. And just acting-wise, I think he does a fine part, you know, a fine job with the
part. And Danny DeVito has a definite recognizable voice, and the voice they have, you know, Danny DeVito's regular voice works for the character.
Yeah, I mean, this was kind of typecasting. You know, we need a short, cranky mentor guy, Danny DeVito. Yeah, I mean, but also Danny DeVito just naturally is incredibly expressive in a very particular way, kind of like Whoopi Goldberg is. We talked about Whoopi Goldberg and how they used so much of her facial movement in The Hyena, so that you could tell immediately who was going to be voicing this character before you even saw it. And it's exactly the same with Phil. The second you see this character, before you know anything about him, you know that that's going to be Danny DeVito's voice when it opens its mouth, you know.
Which did make it a bit of an issue when they went to the TV show, because now you have to find a guy that sounds like Danny DeVito, because Danny DeVito ain't going to work for animation scale.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Phil refuses to train Herc. He's retired. All of the heroes he's trained turn out to be disappointments. Even Achilles. They make a big point of Achilles in this story. Everyone he's trained has been a disappointment. His dream was to train the greatest hero ever, one that the gods will immortalize in the stars, but he's given up. When Herc tells Phil that his father is Zeus, Phil makes fun of it. Ah, Daddy, read me a book, Daddy Zeus. And we get to the song One Last Hope. Before we even get to that, I remember one thing about this film and the behind the scenes of this film. It had to been, because it wasn't Macon that said this, because, you know, it had to been the other guy. But what they say is, when Danny DeVito sings, he no longer sounds like Danny DeVito. So they really couldn't have him sing as like his own singing voice to put his song. So they kind of had him talk sing through the song, just so he still sounds like Danny DeVito.
Huh. I thought it was one of those things where, like, he can't really carry a tune, so we make him talk sing. Because you don't really think of Danny DeVito and think that guy's going to be a good singer.
Well, Danny DeVito has done some stage productions. He's not a stranger to it. So it's, I guess they had him sing, and it was like, you're too good. I think that was the situation. At least that was what the intent of the interview was. He was too good of a singer to still sound like himself when he was doing this song. And it's very much very obvious a talk sing style that they have Danny DeVito do. And he's just refusing it. I am not gonna train it. And then he gets struck by lightning by Zeus, and then he agrees.
Yeah.
One last shot of training a true hero, and Herc's training doesn't go as well first. It's that poor training doll. Just that poor training doll. If that doll could feel pain.
Yeah, let's be glad that is an inanimate object with no sentience.
But he eventually gets it, and he bulks up as we see the passage. You know, when we see Phil measuring the muscle on Herc, you know, it's very small. By the end of the song, he's bulked up. It breaks the tape, you know.
Yeah, you gotta have a montage.
Yep. And again, in the middle of this song, we get a 65-episode animated series.
Yeah. Like, Danny DeVito takes a breath before continuing a line, and that's where the series takes place.
It's like the Beauty and the Beast sequel. It takes place right in the middle of that... Something there, yeah.
Yeah.
They blink, and there's an entire sequel right there. So anyway, the training has completed. Hercules is now bulked up. He can do a bunch of tricks with some stuff. He can bend a sword and use it as a boomerang. Don't know how that works, but it's a cartoon.
Ah, yes, the great might of the hero, doing tricks with stuff.
You know, he has the arrows fired at him, and he makes the H shape in the seal. That's a Superman thing right there.
Oh, yeah. You almost expected somebody to, like, you know, fire an arrow at his head, and then it bounces off, and they get mad and just throw the bow at him. I'm really mad that scene wasn't in there, to be honest.
And then Hercules ducks the bow.
Yeah.
So now we get to adult Hercules, now voiced by Tate Donovan. Yeah, we're kind of done with you, Roger. Tate doesn't sing in any of these things. You can go home, Roger Bart.
Yeah. But you know what? If Disney wants to hire me to sing one song and then go home and collect residuals for the rest of forever, I would gladly do that.
So Herc, the adult Herc, 18 years old, as the prophecy says, now he's ready. And Phil gives them a test run in Thebes, but before they get there, they hear a woman in danger. Upon landing, they run into Megara, Susan Egan, trying to get away from the centaur Nicias, voiced by Jim Cummings.
Jim Cummings! He's the other half of your childhood. Love him!
And Herc gets involved, but it doesn't go well as first. It's his first day in the job. He loses his sword. He grabs the fish. It's very, very... very embarrassing first day on the job for Herc. But Herc is able to defeat the centaur. No problem. With a little punchy-punchy and headbutt. And I said use your head, but not that way. Phil straight up calls Herc Wynn a sloppy. He made too many mistakes. That's not what because he got distracted by Megara. And he's still distracted, and he's staring at Megara while she's bending over washing her hair.
Remember what I said about too many men kind of lecherously looking at women? Yeah.
That's a straight up perv moment right there.
Yeah.
I think Phil taught Herc a little too much.
Yeah. You've been around Phil for too many years, boy.
And Pegasus is getting jealous over this. The scenario of the pet getting jealous over the owner's SO. Yeah, even refusing when Herc offers Meg a ride to wherever she was going. Meg says she can handle herself as Trio goes on to Thebes. So let's talk about that introduction of Megara there.
Yeah, well, first we got to talk about the actress.
Yeah.
Because Susan Egan does have some major credit to her name. She was the original Belle in the Broadway version of Beauty and the Beast.
Which makes her one of the few people to play two Disney heroines.
Yeah. So she did that on Broadway, and I have the original cast recording of the Beauty and the Beast Broadway show, and her voice is outstanding. And you can hear it here, even in Meg's speaking voice, that she has a very similar tone to what Paige O'Hara had when she was doing Belle. So she really does have what we now think of as that Disney princess voice.
Only she puts a little bit more sarcasm on it.
Yeah, she plays it a little more sarcastic and fast and loose and comedic, which is what they wanted for the character, but just her vocal quality is very much Disney Princess. Today, you would know her as the voice of Rose Quartz on Steven Universe. So she is continuing to do major animated voiceover work to this day. And she also did the English language versions of a couple of Miyazaki films, including Spirited Away. So she's got a pretty good background there, including not Disney princess, but Disney heroine Megra.
Well, many people think that she should be a Disney princess. You know, she does hook up with the son of God.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if that qualifies you for princess status or not, but, you know, there's a case to be made for almost any woman in a Disney film to earn Disney princess status at this point, so I'm for it. If they want to expand the line, I'm going along with it. I'm not, no complaints. I actually do like Meg as a character. I think Meg is still today probably the big saving grace of this film. She is a brilliant character in a movie that is not always that brilliant. Mm-hmm. I would have loved to have seen a lot more of her. Like, I would have loved just like a Meg spinoff. I want to see the backstory that got her here.
Well, we know some of the backstory, but I would like to see that evolution. Yeah. She's like the good girl. She has this love of her life. Poop went down, and then she becomes this sarcastic woman because there's really all the joys in her life was taken away.
Yeah. Or maybe she was always a sarcastic woman. She was just happy and sarcastic. It exists.
I know. I've known you this long. I'm just trying to make it how Disney would make it, you know?
Yeah, I can see Disney definitely being like, sarcasm is only for the chronically depressed who have nothing else going for them. I mean, that's true in my life, but it's not true in general, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, she's one of the very, very, really, really good characters in this movie that, you know, to this day, everyone, there's so many women that cosplay as Meg at various conventions that, you know, it's just, they identify with this woman so much, especially with the harassment that Meg gets in this movie.
Yeah. But also, Meg has a really good heart. She's portrayed as, you know, working for the villain, and she is under duress, but all of her motivations at every step along the way are pure-hearted. Mm-hmm. She is, yeah, she's sarcastic, and yeah, she's a bit gruff, but she's never once unkind, and she's never once morally ambiguous. Like, she's forced to do Hades' bidding, but it's always under protest. You always know that she's never wanting to do it. She never agrees with the plan. You know, how she ended up in that situation in the first place was pure. Everything she does along the way is absolutely the most upstanding and unselfish person in the entire movie. Just brilliant from a moral, ethical standpoint.
Which is a lot more than the actual mythological Megara has.
Yeah, I mean, they changed everybody in this, of course. I'm just gonna go with that.
Speaking of Meg, let's go. Meg is in a dark forest, and she runs into two woodland creatures. Another case of Disney making fun of itself, as Meg calls them two rodents looking for a theme park.
Yeah.
Again, Disney at this point, they know people are making fun of them. Might as well make some bucks off of it. Making fun of ourselves. And the two rodents are Pain and Panic, which means Hades is there too. And turns out Meg was supposed to get Nessus, which turns out to be the Water Guardian, to join Hades' team for this big takeover. And as we saw, it didn't go so well. And, excuse me. Someone came to my door for a second. I'll edit this part out.
Yep.
So Meg goes on how Wonder Boy, and I love that nickname she gave him.
Yeah.
Wonder Boy, Hercules got involved, and Hades then goes after Pain and Panic because they didn't get the job done 18 years ago. Which, again, this completely puts the TV show in under suspect because Hades is not supposed to know Hercules is alive.
Yeah, and Hades is in that show, like, every episode.
Yeah.
It's, I'm just going to give you one villain tip for all you aspiring cartoonish villains out there. Always check up on your minions. Yeah. Like, you know, if you send your henchman out to do a deed, just go double check. Henchmen are very unreliable as a species. Can we call them a species? I don't know. But henchmen are very unreliable. Always check up on your henchmen. It will save you pain 18 years later.
And I realize for a movie set in Greece, there is a lot of Yiddish slang. For Sugarner, Shamil.
Yeah, both Danny DeVito and James Woods lean heavily into the Yiddish slang.
I don't know if that was intentional or ad-libs.
Yeah, I have no idea. I know a lot of James Woods' dialogue was ad-libbed, especially the scenes between Hades and Meg. I don't know how much of Danny DeVito's was. So, I don't know.
So, well, Hercules is still mortal. We know this. Pain and Panic make a point. He's still mortal. So, Hades plans to correct this oversight.
You want something done, you gotta do it yourself.
Pretty much. So, Herc, Phil, and Pegasus arrive in Thebes, clearly based on the personality of New York City.
Yeah.
Like, how I was thinking when watching this, Oliver and Company is very much 80s New York. Thieves in Hercules is very much 90s New York.
I was thinking even 70s New York, you know, grungier before the big Times Square cleanup and stuff like that. Because we do have that nice 70s reference of I'm walking here.
Yeah,
you know, out of Phil when they almost get run over by a cart,
and the dude with the what we thought was a flasher ends up being a sundial salesman.
Yeah, I do kind of like the idea of knockoff designer sundials. That did make me laugh. I will give it that. That's one kind of modern reference that I did like.
The entire thing with Thieves is filled with pop culture references from stoplights and all that stuff. Anyway, The people of Thebes complain about the various disasters and crime that plague the city. Herc steps in, announces himself as a hero, and he'll help. But people aren't buying it. Even if he was a hero, they need a professional, not an amateur.
People including at least two more versions of Jim Cummings.
Pretty much.
Because Jim Cummings is at least two of the crowd in there. I caught his voice. He is definitely the old man. And he's also definitely the tall man that is the spokesman for the group throughout the movie, the one that talks most.
Yeah.
So
Jim Cummings' old man voice is very similar to the Tigger voice.
Yeah. It's a similar vocal quality to that.
Yeah, so Herc slumps. How can he prove himself a hero if there's no chance to be a hero? He makes a point. You know, how can I prove myself with the job if you're not letting me do the job?
Yeah.
Meg arrives, asking for help. Two kids trapped under a rock slide in a gorge, and they're off. And I'm going to say this whole scene probably has the most clever joke in the movie. Somebody call IXII!
Yeah, that is really the one joke that I remember at the time. That was the joke that hit. You know, it's like, if we were going to quote anything from this movie, it was going to be either that one or if it's good.
Yeah.
You know, those two things are really the only kind of surviving jokes I remember from my childhood.
One turns out to be a meme, and we'll get to that meme later on.
Yeah.
It's not the one you're thinking of. Herc lifts a giant boulder, setting the kids free to a small smattering of applause from the crowd. And it turns out the kids were Pain and Panic. This was all planned by Hades. Herc just released the Hydra. Hail Hydra!
No.
No.
I refuse.
Herc is at first outmatched. A single-headed Hydra, but we'll get to that. Even getting eaten by the monster, but Herc is able to cut the Hydra's head off from inside. Do you know what happens when you cut the head off a Hydra?
anybody who's seen a Marvel movie does.
But in this case, three more grow in its place. And Herc, flying on Pegasus, he's just cutting off head after head after head. This scene is so violent for a Disney movie. Constant head chopping.
Also, this scene is really bad CGI.
Yeah.
This does not hold up at all. Oh, this was painful to watch.
The Hydra is completely CG in this scene.
And it does not look like it even belongs in the same film. Something about the animation style they used for this film did not translate to 3D render. And it shows. This is probably the worst one we've had yet of the early forays into CG with Disney.
So now at this point, the Hydra has hundreds of heads and has Herc pinned against a wall with his hand. So Herc hits the side of the gorge as hard as he can, causing a rock slide, killing the Hydra. Herc survives because the hand that he was in didn't get crushed by the rocks. Big cheer from the crowd, and, well, Hades' plans failed. What can you do? But this one act now shows that Herc is the real deal. He is a hero to the people, which leads us to our next song, Zero to Hero. Which this song has a lot of wordplay in it. Now, we talked about it last week with Pocahontas, but this has a lot of wordplay that just will not translate well. I don't think it does. Even the phrase Zero to Hero.
Yeah.
The every vase, every vase.
Yeah, there's a lot of that very language-based, you know, pun-based humor in this one. Also, I was shocked watching this again that the only part of the song that I remembered is, like, the bridge. There's, like, the breakdown bridge in there, and it's the... If when you think of this song, this is the part you remember.
Yeah, bless my
soul. Who put the Glad and Gladiator, Hercules? That part is really the only part that I remembered. That and the Zero to Hero, yes, indeed. You know, that part. So, it does have, and frequently, a lot of clever wordplay, but it's still, I don't know, it's kind of like Go the Distance. There's something about it that just absolutely failed with me, except for that one kind of breakdown in the middle. That's a cool part of the song, and that's catchy, and that will stick in your head. But that's, like, maybe a third of the song tops?
Yeah. And I'm even remembering now that you said, who put the Gladiator Hercules? That's, you know, at the also time, there was that remake of The Absent-Minded Professor. Hercules, Hercules, Hercules.
Yeah. And so we made that joke all the time as kids. Who put the Glad in Gladiator? Hercules, Hercules, Hercules. You know, that was a joke that went around my high school at the time.
So yeah, Hercules has become well known for defeating monsters, all sent by Hades. And this also leads to merchandising deals with stuff with its likeness on it. Plates, vases. As we said before, the Air Herc sandals. The fact that that you cannot go to Disney and buy some Air Herc sandals is a crime.
Yeah, that was probably one where the joke did not turn into a workable licensing deal. I think they probably approached Nike and were like, "Hey, how about a collab here?" And Nike was probably like, "No, we're sleeping on a pile of money as it is, and you guys have a history." So
this movie, honestly, has probably the most pop culture references than any of the other Renaissances. Any of the Renaissance film, this is just joke after joke. I mean, and they kind of make this, and they announce this movie as a comedy, straight up, when they announce this movie. And a lot of the comedy doesn't quite work so well, since a lot of it is pop culture jokes and puns.
Yeah, I think if you were to show this to your kid today, you know, those of you out there that have kids, I don't think your kid would find any joy in this film at all, because so much of it is dependent on having been a kid in 1995.
Yeah, you know, if you're a 90s kid, yeah, you'll get this movie right away. Outside of it, it's not going to hold up. I mean, it's a bit of a fast forward of our behalf, but, you know. Yeah, so that's much we can say about that.
Yeah. That's the problem with doing quote-unquote topical humor. Yeah. And like I said, it was already a little dated, most of these, by the time the film came out. But it would probably be almost incomprehensible to a kid today. They would get the main plot line, of course, but why this movie was supposed to be funny, I think, would completely pass them by.
Yeah. So every obstacle Hades throws at Herc, he gets past it. And now we fast forward to 24 hours left for Hades' plan to get together. But here's the meme I was going to talk about. Because Hades is making the is making this big speech. He hears squeaking and he sees Pain wearing the Air Herc sandals. And he looks down there and he says, "What are those?"
Yeah.
So yes, Hercules, Hades, James Woods invented the "What are those" meme.
Yeah, I don't know. This movie is so much montage. That's the other thing that we really need to point out, is that everybody remembers that there's the training montage scene, but there are so many other montage scenes. There's the training montage scene, there's the beating up of the monsters montage scene during Zero to Hero, then there's the second merchandising montage scene within Zero to Hero. And then we get kind of the, you know, fast-forwardy montage to, like, oh, only 24 hours left. I mean, there's a good chunk of this movie that is nothing but montage.
You could probably do a second Hercules series based on him being a hero and during Zero to Hero.
Yeah, there's probably a point right in the middle of that song where you could drop another 3-season series.
Anyway, so new plan for Hades. Hades has a new plan. Hades plans to send Meg to seduce Herc and find out his weaknesses. But Meg says she's done with men. And then we learn Meg's backstory. She sold her soul to save her boyfriend's life, and then he left her for another woman. So Meg's had it rough.
Yeah.
She.
You want to hear, I want to see a mashup of Meg with Lizzo's Truth Hurts. Like, why men great till they gotta be great? I gave you my soul and you left me for another woman. That is a Lizzo song right there. If they remake Hercules as a live action, I want there to be a breakdown with Lizzo as, like, the really awesome, snarky muse.
Yeah, Lizzo could probably play the muse.
Singing the backstory of Meg in a Truth Hurts kind of style.
Disney, get on that.
That is the only way I will accept doing this as a live-action remake. Get Lizzo as the cool muse and have her sing a Truth Hurts backstory for Meg. There we go. That is the line in the sand I am drawing, Disney. You can take it or leave it.
But Hades gives Meg a deal. If you do this, then he will grant Meg her freedom. You will no longer subservient to me. You get your soul back. Everything. It's, you know, you get your freedom. So Meg doesn't really have much of a choice here. You know, she could continue her servitude. We never see how long that servitude is. We know that she was going to have 2 years off, then 2 years added. We don't know exactly the length of this servitude, but Hades is willing to forego all of it and give Meg her freedom if she helps Hades stop Hercules.
Yeah, knowing Hades in this movie, it's probably like, you know, a billion-year contract or something. I'll take 2 years off your billion-year contract.
Your life sentence.
Yeah.
So Herc returns to the Temple of Zeus, and he's believed that he's become a true hero. He's ready to join the gods. I got an action figure. Meek, meek, meek.
Yeah, that was. It's kind of the opposite of the kung fu grip. It's like the
as much as I hate
flex.
As much as I hate saying it, the I'm an action figure. It kind of qualifies as the shot of this movie because that
it
was
really
everywhere.
Is. Yeah, that one joke was kind of the punchline to every trailer and commercial at the time. I'm an action figure. Squeak squeak. Yeah. You're right. That one is kind of the shot. There, I didn't really think about it, but yeah, there isn't really one that I would qualify as the shot in this movie, I don't think. There's not one that immediately comes to mind, but yeah, if anything comes close, it's the action figure joke.
So, Zeus kind of has to break it to him. Like, yeah, just because you're famous doesn't make you a hero. He's got to find
James Woods.
Yeah.
Sorry.
There's a lot of people that need to be told just because you're famous doesn't make you a hero.
Amen to that.
Just because you can throw a ball doesn't make you a hero.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's something that Hercules needs to discover himself, because Zeus can't tell him what a hero is. He needs to discover what a hero is. In a way, he's right. You can tell someone how to be a hero. They need to find their own path to be one. So then we go to Herc's very lavish home, because, you know, he's made all this money being a hero. And he wonders what the point of it all is. And we get a cameo by Scar from The Lion King.
Yeah. This is actually a really fun little joke for mythology nerds.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Scar is in there, because the slaying of the Nemean lion is one of the famous labors of Hercules. And the fact that the Nemean lion turns out to be Scar is absolutely hilarious. And at the time, I thought that was the best joke of the movie, even better than IXII.
It's also a callback to Lion King, where Zazu says that Scar will make a very good throw rug.
Yeah, or a cape, you know, yeah. A cape here. But I just absolutely love the throwback of, like, oh, we should reference the labors of Hercules, because there are other references to the labors of Hercules, but that's the one that kind of gets the most screen time, is the Nemean lion, which I still to this day find that a brilliant joke. Bravo to Disney. I hope whoever came up with that joke got, like, a bonus for that, because that was such a good joke.
And then we get the horde of screaming fangirls barging in and ripping off Hercules' clothes. Phil is able to get the girls out of there and then chases after them himself.
Notice, I'm just going to put this out there. Notice that all the time men are being lecherous and weird toward women, it's just kind of taken as a minor annoyance at most, but kind of normal. The second women respond in the same way to Hercules, both with the muse and with the fangirls, it's considered, like, pathetic and weird and get a grip on yourself and ugh, fangirls. So, you know, double standard.
I do like how Hercules asked for help with the girls, like, help me, Phil.
Yeah. This seems to have happened enough that they already have a plan in place.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Usual escape plan, you know.
Yeah. And it looks like Mega snuck in as well and finds Herc in his hiding place, because he's not a very good hider, apparently.
Yeah. Those air Hercs peeking out from underneath the...
Yeah. And convinces Herc to skip out on the day and spend it with her. Don't blame the guy for that. I really don't.
No, she's an amazing woman. I want to go hang out with Meg for an afternoon. That'd be awesome.
Especially the date when we find out, you know, what their date went like afterwards. Oedipus.
Yeah, that is a weird joke to throw into a kid's movie. Like, be glad that Google really wasn't a thing.
That was definitely a joke for the parents.
Yeah, that was a, like, please hope your kid doesn't ask why this is funny. Because, yeah.
So, as they're having their discussion of their date, Meg pretends to fall, saying she has weak ankles, and proceeds to act Herc if has any weak ankles. If he has any weaknesses, Herc says he has none, and he wishes he could be like everyone else, and that starts their different conversation. Meg says, ordinary
Herc,
people
hurt. Herc does have a weakness, which is that he doesn't catch giant red flags when they're waving in front of him.
He's a bit oblivious. He's a farm boy.
Yeah. From the farms of Kansas, Greece. All the cornfields of Kansas, Greece.
So, you know, I mean, so Meg's been through some stuff, and we find that out in this conversation about how it's probably not even this guy that dumped her was the first person to ever hurt her. So, you know, so how all these people, you know, they'll stab you in the back and all that stuff. And then, you know,
this is why I'm saying there's got to be more to that story. This is why I want the Lizzo version of this story. I want a whole movie where I find out what happened to Meg, because it seems like there's something. I'm not saying that selling your soul to save the life of the man you love and then having him dump you for a hotter chick or whatever would not be an exceedingly traumatic event, but you're right that it does seem like that wasn't the first or the last time.
That was the straw that broke the camel's back, honestly.
Yeah, so I want a whole, give me my Meg
Disney Plus
movie.
Disney Plus original series.
Yeah, you need something to keep those subscribers going, Disney. Come on, chop two.
And Susan Egg is still doing work. We can bring her back. She still sounds like Meg all these years later.
Yeah, she has been doing the voice for, you know, Kingdom Hearts and stuff and other little tie-in things here and there. So,
at
bring her back.
At one of the Disney conventions, she actually sang her song, and we'll get to that song in a minute.
Yeah, but so, Meg movie, I want it.
Meg the series, let's make that happen. Herc does say that he will never hurt Meg, which, if you know the actual mythological story of Hercules and what he ends up doing to Meg.
Yeah. Don't make promises you can't keep, buddy. Although this is a Disney movie, so you're probably safe in this instance.
And the two almost kiss. I mean, even Meg is saying we shouldn't be doing this, because, again, she's been hurt before. She doesn't want to get hurt again. But before that comes in, we get another pop culture reference of a helicopter with Pegasus as a helicopter with a spotlight with the candle.
That is so weird. I had forgotten that was in the movie, and then it showed up in the movie during the rewatch, and my brain just went, what? Because even for this movie, with all its modern references, that just comes out of nowhere. I don't know. It just, that was one joke too far for me, I think.
Yeah, and they're there to take Herc home, because he walked out on his duties for the day. Well, before they leave, Herc does give Meg a peck on the cheek. So they do get some form of affection there going. And as he's riding Pegasus home, Herc doesn't look forward at all. Always look forward when you're driving, kids, which leads to Phil getting knocked off.
Yeah.
Meg looks to fallen for old Wonder Boy, and she doesn't like it. Which leads to her song, which I believe is the best song in this movie, I Won't Say I'm in Love.
Absolutely the best song in the movie. You are not incorrect.
This should have been the single.
Yeah, you should have had, like, a really awesome 90s pop starlet doing this song.
Who could we have gotten at the time? Because we already did. I mean, 1905 was.
I mean, you could have gone with the... Was Britney Spears a thing by that point? I can't remember exactly when she came along.
Maybe at the beginning. Maybe the Spice Girls.
We already had Disney Channel stars by that point. Possible. That they could have used that to launch one of their, you know, Disney Channel girl. Well, you know, no.
Carlson Romano. Let's get Kim Possible to sing this song.
Well, Britney Spears was on the Mickey Mouse Club.
Yeah.
So, you know, it very well.
So was Christina Aguilera.
Already on it by that, and Christina Aguilera would have also been a good choice. I'm not sure exactly how far along in their careers they were at this point. Would this have been too early for somebody like Gwen Stefani or something? That was kind of toward the height of her fame with No Doubt. There, possible. She's got a pretty good voice for it. But yeah, there were a ton of Alanis Morissette. I would not have wanted to hear Mariah Carey do this song. I just wouldn't have. I don't think vocally this is the style for it. But yeah, there were so many. The 90s was a great time for, like, you know, strong, snarky female pop singers. Why was this not a single release? This song is brilliant. And as we said before, this is our doo-wop song of the movie. And it's very much girl group-y.
Yeah. Like I said, Spice Girls.
Yeah, Spice Girls could have done it. And all, but this very much is like, you could have thought of this as like a Supremes song back in the day.
Yeah.
Very much of that style. You know, you really would think of the Supremes doing a song like this. This song is amazing. I love everything about this song, and I loved it in the rewatch too.
Yeah, so the basic of the song, Meg has not had the best luck with men. And she should know better than to fall for another guy, but she's falling for this other guy. The muses know she's into Herc, but she won't say it. She refuses to admit that she has anything for this guy. Which, I think that's just everybody at some point. Like,
yeah, I think everybody's had that. Yeah, that's a universal human experience. You know, no, I don't want to have a crush on them. That's too much trouble right now. And then, you know, things happen.
Yeah.
But I like this song. It's not as much into the punny wordplay. It doesn't really try to be super funny. I mean, there's a little bit of it. I'm not going to say there isn't. But this is kind of, other than the I Want song, this is kind of the one song that is just kind of a typical Disney song, except it is one of the first deconstructed Disney songs by Disney.
Yeah,
it really is. I mean, before we get
anti-love song
Enchanted and stuff, this is absolutely deconstructing that, like, love at first sight, glory of falling in love. And it's the first time Disney was like, no, there's actually kind of a downside sometimes to falling in love. You know, there's pain there, and there's, you know, a bit of uncertainty in that. It could go very wrong. You could be very hurt by this. But it's still a hopeful song. It's absolutely not telling Meg to run away and not admit it.
It reminds me of the song I'll Never Fall in Love Again.
Yeah.
The whole song says, I'm never going to fall in love again until that last verse, until the next time I fall in love.
And the muses are absolutely the voice of reason. Like, okay, yeah, but it could also be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, I like the back and forth that, yes, you could be in pain from admitting it, but there's probably more pain from, you know, keeping it silent and never acknowledging it, even to yourself.
Yeah, this is also the main time where the muses are interacting with the characters in the story.
Yeah, but remember that Meg is also kind of... I mean, yes, Hercules is too, but Meg is kind of on that line between the supernatural and the mortal. You know, we don't actually know what the status is of Meg. At this point in the movie, is she even mortal? Is she dead at this point in the movie? We don't know the terms of selling her soul. You know, was giving her soul like a similar trade that we see later in the movie? Like, you know, you're here and you're dead and the other person gets to live? Or is it like, your soul is mine bound in servitude, but you're still mortal? We don't know. So
that's
the part
we don't know anyway.
It's very possible that Meg has connections with all of the other deities and demigods and other creatures of Greek mythology. It's just normal for her.
Yeah, I guess
you
so.
Know?
So anyway, Hades is here. She wants intel. He wants intel from Meg, and she refuses. She will not help him anymore. At this point, Phil has recovered consciousness and sees Meg talking to Hades. And it's gonna hurt. It hurts him because he has to tell her that your girlfriend's working for the Lord of the Underworld. And Meg says Herc has no weaknesses. You can't beat him. You can't. Nothing you throw against him will work because he has no weaknesses. But Hades does know one weakness. Her. And if you, let's be honest, for a lot of guys, their girl, you threaten their girl, they're gonna do stuff. That's just a thing.
Yeah, and also I like that the fact that she's holding on to the flowers, her tell.
Yeah.
You know, that Herc had given her a flower, and she had been holding it through the entire song.
Mm-hmm.
And now that Hades shows up, he sees the flower and puts two and two together and realizes, like, okay, there's... You know, there's one weakness that most mortals have, and it's love. And I don't even think that's, like, a guy thing so much.
Well,
Meg
you look
did
at
the exact same
yeah,
thing for
true.
Her boyfriend.
Yeah.
You know, it's if there is a person you love, whether it's romantic love or whatever, but, you know, if there is a person you love, I think most people would go far and beyond what they think they would if, you know, someone they love really... dependent on it, especially if it was a life and death situation.
Mm-hmm. So Phil eventually makes it back to the stadium or their house or whatever. He tries
yeah,
to tell
exactly
Herc
a stadium.
Yeah, Herc has his own private stadium because he's rich.
<It's> just...
So Phil makes it back and tries to tell Herc the truth, but he won't listen because he's just in love with Meg. He just doesn't not want to hear anything negative about her.
But also, this one's on Phil. Because Phil doesn't come back and say, like, Herc, I need you to sit down. I need you to listen to something that's going to be difficult. He just comes in, and Hercules is like, oh, isn't Meg the most wonderful? And Phil just starts screaming, like, she's a liar and a cheat and a fraud and a whatever, with no backing. I think if Phil had sat down and been like, look, I saw her talking to Hades. I overheard her say she was working for him. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think that scene would have gone a little bit differently because, you know, I mean, imagine somebody tells you about your romantic partner or crush or whatever. Like, the real story is I caught them stealing money from your best friend's backpack. You know, I physically watch them steal something. But instead of that, they just come in and they're like, your boyfriend is horrible. And I just, you know, he's just the worst. He's the absolute awful. You need to dump him right now. You're not going to take that the same way that you're going to take, like, look, I need to sit down and break something. I hate to be the one to tell you this, but I physically witnessed him. You know, reach into a backpack and steal money. You know, like...
It's the trope of most of these movies of the misunderstanding.
Yeah, and
a
it
lot of
does
people
not
hate
work
it.
Here.
Yeah.
I dislike it here. There are some times where a misunderstanding is to use the word, understandable. You know, it fits in the flow of the story. But in this one, it's like, Phil knows this is going to break his Hercules' heart. And yeah, Phil is brash and everything, but I think that he would... Everything in this movie says to me that Phil would have sat Herc down and had, like, the difficult chat rather than just, like, screaming nonsense at him.
And as this is going on, Pegasus sees a female Pegasus and follows it, turns out it's Pain and Panic, and they kidnap him.
My little Pegasus, my little Peg. It even has the cutie mark.
Yeah.
It has the curled hair that all the My Little Ponies did. It has the cutie mark. It has the weird, non-natural color for a horse. You know, this is My Little Pony. This is absolutely. It's like, hey, girls, remember My Little Pony? Here's one of them. But we don't own that company, so we're going to make it not exactly that, you know?
Yeah. And in their argument, Herc accidentally hits Phil. And Phil leaves. He's done. If Herc won't listen, so be it. Like you said, you know, the all-time champ, not the all-time chump.
Yeah.
And like you said, this is partially on Phil, because he approached the situation wrong.
Yeah. But points for Phil, no matter who you are, if anybody in your life ever hits you in anger, leave. That's, no. I don't care what your relationship to them is, no. Don't do that.
And it's at this point where Hades shows up, introduces himself. This is the first time Hades and Hercules have ever met in this entire movie. Which, again, throws the series out the window.
Yeah, and what's strange is that even if Phil had sat down and said she's working with Hades, would that have meant anything to Hercules? I thought about that afterwards, too. Like,
I'm pretty sure he knows of the gods and what they do. He probably knows that Hades is the Lord of the Dead.
Hades be after him? He doesn't know his backstory, really. Because I don't think Zeus knows that Hades was the reason for the potion. It's just something happened, you got turned mortal, you know, so Zeus couldn't have told him.
It's possible Zeus didn't know. It's possible.
Yeah,
He just knows that one day his child was kidnapped and turned mortal. That's all he knows.
Yeah, and so why would Hercules have any reason to think Hades specifically meant him harm? Yeah, my dog agrees with me. But, yeah, he actually doesn't know there's a villain working against him until this moment in the movie, find interesting.
And it's at this point, Hades just spills it out for him. You've been in my way this whole time. And he has plans for tomorrow, and he needs Herc to not be in the way. And as the incentive, he has Meg. He will let Meg go under the condition that Herc gives up his powers for 24 hours. 24 hours, no godlike powers, you let me do what I have to do. At the end of the 24 hours, you get your powers back. And Herc adds the clause there. If anything happens to Meg, deal is off. And they agree. And very odd shake is Herc is just drained completely, physically.
Yeah.
They even go as far as to remove the color from his body in the animation, which is perfect.
Yeah, it is. It is a really cool little animation trick there.
And Herc gets his wish. Now he is just like everybody else, even throwing the weights at him to show you can't lift this anymore. You know. And insult to injury, Hades reveals that Meg has been his partner in his plans the entire time. Hey, all those monsters I've been sending at you? Hey, Meg was in on that. This entire thing to hurt people and take over Olympus? Meg knew. She helped me. She told me all about you. She seduced you to be part of this thing. And that... Now, you say that. Imagine if Herc had had to talk with Phil, as you said, and then this happens. would that scene, would Herc have even agreed to the deal?
Well, no. I mean, for plot reasons, of course, you need the scene to go exactly the way it did. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that, you know, it does seem contrived and not terribly realistic to the characters they have built to that point in the movie.
Like Film Brain would say, because the plot says so.
Yeah, because the plot said so. Yeah.
So Hercules is... Hades. I'm misreading my notes here.
Too many H names.
Yes. Hades is off as the planets have aligned, and the way they animated the planets aligning is nice. You know, even using the actual way the planets looked versus anything else.
Yeah.
And the Titans' prison is revealed. Hades sets them free to get their revenge on Zeus. Yes, the Titans have names, but they're only really... We only know them by their element. Rock, ice, fire, and wind.
Yeah. And eyeball.
Yes.
ice, fire, wind, and eyeball.
Eventually, they make their way to Olympus. That is... Again, one of the few funny jokes in this movie. Guys, Olympus is that way.
Yeah, literally the tallest mountain, as far as the eye can see, you head the opposite direction.
So yes, go ahead.
Maybe you should have used the power of eyeball. The way they do the Titans in this, okay, once again showing my age, but... You know, there was that, like, commercial or whatever for the toothpaste that had, like, the little germs or whatever. They would just go, like, we make holes in teeth. And they would lumber around. That's all I could think of with the Titans. Because they're just like, you know, we kill Zeus. We hurt Zeus. And they just kind of stomp around and lumber around. And that was all I could think of, was that this is exactly as one-dimensional a portrayal as you can think of, as the little, you know, we make holes in teeth.
Yeah, like, what are you gonna do to Zeus? Crush him, freeze him, melt him, blow him away, and then look at him eyeball. Really hard.
Eyeball! You know, if you got Cyclops together with the Fates, they could have, like, binocular vision.
Perception. Cyclops was not one of the Titans again, but
I think they just needed a final monster for Herc to face on his own.
Yeah, and that's what he does. Hades sends the Cyclops to go to Thebes and attack there and try to get Hercules out, and, you know, likely kill him because he has no powers.
The interesting thing is that the guy who does the voice of the Cyclops has had kind of an interesting voice actor career, Patrick Penny. He was Mighty Mouse in a very small run, Mighty Mouse The New Adventures.
Hey, yeah, I saw that on, like, Fox back in the day.
Yeah, he was also in the animated series of Fraggle Rock, not the one with actual Muppets, but the animated one they did later. He was in SpongeBob. He was in the Curse of Monkey Island video game. And he does lots of other voices here and there for various things. But so he's one of those kind of, you know, consistent working voice guys, but probably not a household name.
So anyway, let's go to Olympus, where Hermes sees the Titans approaching. Zeus calls for the all-out attack. It's gods versus Titans, and the Titans are winning.
This is the interesting part where, if I remember correctly, we get our other kind of voice acting legend in there, as we see Apollo as one of the gods who is fighting, voiced by the absolute legend himself, Keith David. Keith David is just the greatest voice, and I'm not even sure he does character voices. He's one of those that, you know, it's like you get him for his speaking voice. You know, very much a Morgan Freeman kind of thing there. You know, you get him for that voice.
It's Goliath, it's the Shadow Man, it's the same
voice. And or the other half of the greatest fight scene in history, They Live with Roddy Piper, a live action film. But that 5-minute extended fight scene in They Live between the great Rowdy Roddy Piper and Keith David, where he tries to make, where Keith David tries to make him put on glasses, is the funniest thing in history.
There's a funny version of that scene where they replace the entire soundtrack with music and sounds from the Street Fighter video games.
Yeah. But that is a great scene. Go look it up if you want. But yeah, Keith David, better known to kind of rabid Disney property fans as Goliath from Gargoyles. And now you can catch him on Rick and Morty as the president, the U.S. president, whenever that character appears a couple of times. So, Keith David, I love him. I really do. I'm such a fan, and he's just kind of a quick blip in this movie, but it's still good to have him.
I can see them be like, hey, Keith, I know you're kind of done doing Gargoyles for the day. Could you read this line for Hercules?
Yeah, I'm almost entirely certain that's how it went down, honestly. You want to do an extra line read for a different movie? Yeah.
So anyway, the Cyclops attacks Thebes, and the people wonder where Hercules is. And even with no strength, Hercules goes to face the Cyclops. You know, there's that conversation with Meg, you know, you'll die if you go out there. Well, there's things worse than death, and that's as cold as Hercules gets in this movie.
Yeah, that is an excellent burn. Yeah, Hercules in this film is not known as a great wit. You know, he's kind of a doofus for most of the movie, but that is a burn.
And Hercules ends up getting his butt kicked because he has no powers. Right into the Air Herc billboard. Oh, that Air Herc. Anyway, on Olympus, the Titans have reached the gates and gotten in, and all the gods have been captured. Hephaestus has been captured. I've been captured.
Yeah, the Hermes being captured scene is really, really great. I like that. I love the animation. I love Paul Schaefer's delivery on that. Everything about that little bit is really good.
And the Titans imprison Zeus. More or less out of how he imprisoned them. Hades then reveals his role in the whole thing. You know, hey, this is my idea, I did all this, and I'm going to take over. Meg and Pegasus. So Meg goes back, frees Pegasus, and, you know, obviously Pegasus kind of doesn't want to deal with Meg, but she straight up tells him Hercules is in trouble, and they need Phil. And they go to get Phil, as Phil is about to get on a barge going back to his little dilapidated island. And when they tell Phil Herc's in trouble, he just jumps on and he may not like Meg, but he's going to help his boy.
Apologies for the dog. Humans decided to exist outside my house.
So anyway, Phil gets there and gives Herc the pep talk. You know, it's like, and even with no powers, Herc is able to defeat the Cyclops. Which... pretty ingenious way he does it by tripping him up.
Yeah, it's we call that the ATHE defense.
ever seen that old movie Return of the Jedi out on the snow planet?
Yeah, I don't think the power of eyeball really stood a chance. I mean, I could defeat the power of eyeball, you know.
The landing of the Titan, the Cyclops Titan, causes a pillar to fall. Meg pushes Herc out of the way and is crushed. Because Meg got hurt, Herc gets his powers back because, you know, That was part of the deal. And now with his powers back, he's going to go help the other gods defeat the other Titans, and Phil watches over Meg. So when Herc doesn't, it doesn't take very long for Herc to free the gods. All he does is cut their chains. With godlike chains being cut by a mortal sword.
I don't know. Maybe the sword also proved it was a true hero.
I don't know. So with the gods free, Zeus attacks the Titans, causing them to run. And of course, he needs to go back and fight. This is what you wanted. Then Herc is able to grab the Wind Titan, capture the other three Titans, and tosses them off into space where they explode. Well, that takes care of that.
Yeah, that was a weird ending for the Titans. You would have expected them to just go back in their cage or something, but yeah. Okay.
So 18 years of planning, that's all gone to pot. But Meg is still dying. So he can have that. He's going, you know, if he can't rule Olympus, he'll take Meg from Hercules.
Yeah.
And in the underworld, the fates cut Meg's lifeline. She dead. And there's that very sad scene of where Herc gets there and he's too late. He realizes he's too late. And there's Meg just dead. And The way they animated with her hand just going limp as soon as they cut the lifeline. Like, you didn't... There's ways Disney can make death look dramatic without ever showing blood.
Yeah, it really is a very kind of dramatic scene, undercut by the howling Cerberus in the other room. I apologize for that. I'm so sorry to all the listeners that there's just like random howling in the background. But my dog gets very annoyed when the garbage truck comes by, and the garbage truck just came by, so he has to defend the home from the garbage truck, and I apologize. Anyway, this is interesting to me in how not emotional this scene was. The animation was beautiful. Mm-hmm. The way they chose to portray, like, oh, her lifeline's been cut, and, you know, the hand losing energy in the wrist and stuff, that was all beautiful. But there's something in the movie that the emotional weight of it doesn't resonate. And Disney can do that very well.
I think it comes to the point where you know this is not going to... This death will not stand.
Yeah, I think that is a big part of it. I mean, you know, we are all still traumatized by the death of Mufasa. You know, Disney can absolutely rip your heart out with stuff like that. You know, no specific spoilers, but boy, did they do a couple of those in Frozen 2. I mean, there's some moments in there that you're like, I don't care how happy a ending this movie is going to have eventually. This is sad right now, you know, like, but in this movie, it just, there was absolutely no emotional weight to it for me. And I don't remember it, you know, from before. I honestly, it had so little emotional weight, I actually forgot Meg had died in the film. I thought that the final battle was just Hades came and grabbed her and was like, no, she's just going to stay in the underworld with me, and then... Hey, I forgot that she was legitimately dead.
Hades taking woman to the underworld, that's a different character entirely?
Yeah.
Anyway, so... I think it's because this film was so lighthearted all the way up to this point. That having a dramatic moment kind of... It's kind of a weird way to go about it, you know? Anyway, let's just keep going here. Phil says there are things you can't change. Herc says, yes, there is a way to change it. And he goes into the underworld, riding on Cerberus. Just busts into Hades' throne room, riding on Cerberus.
Yeah.
Cerberus doesn't get a lot of attention in this movie.
Yeah, but that is a cool flex.
Yeah.
Like, you want to bust into the underworld riding on the guardian dog of the underworld. Bravo. That's excellent entrance. Good job, Herc. Go you.
And with Hades, they go to the River Styx and sees Meg's souls floating with the others. And another deal is made. Herc makes the deal. If he can retrieve her soul, then she will go back to the land of the living. But Hercules has to stay in the underworld. And both sides make the agreement. But the waters gradually age Herc. Herc says that he'll be dead by the time he gets to her, and he'll have both of them. Win-win. And the Fates are ready to cut Herc's lifeline, but it won't cut. And Herc exits the River Styx with Meg's soul glowing like a god. His godhood has been restored. And, you know, Hades is trying to kiss up to Herc. Even the look Hercules gives Hades as he dares to touch her soul. And then punches him right into the River Styx.
Yeah.
Like, don't you dare touch her.
Yeah.
After all the stuff he's done, you dare. And, you know, the dead souls just drag him down. He even says, I'm feeling a little flushed. But Hades is a god. He should be able to get out of there if it's good. I mean, he eventually gets out of there. I mean, he's a god. He eventually gets out of there.
Oh, yeah, of course. I am going to say one thing, because I haven't mentioned it before, but boy, the scissors the fate uses, that is what happens when you let people use your fabric scissors on not fabric things, okay? I'm just, anybody know, when somebody who sews tells you, don't use my fabric scissors, that's what they're talking about. You get manky scissors that can barely cut a single thread. That always annoyed me. I was like, get some better scissors, women. You are doing the ultimate job here. So, I don't know.
Can't cut a god's lifeline, immortal. I mean, the way that the lifeline actually turns gold right before they cut it. I don't know. I always like that scene.
Yeah, it's a good scene.
The thread won't cut.
Well, maybe it's the scissors you're using. Go get some better scissors.
So, Herc returns Meg's soul to her body. She's alive again. They both, you know, even when Meg saved Herc and now Herc saves Meg, they both say, you know, you do crazy things when you're in love. And that's a nice little thing there. But they don't have long to celebrate because they're summoned to Olympus, where Herc receives a hero's welcome from the god. He pretty much gets everything that he wanted in his song from earlier in the movie.
Yep.
He's proven himself a hero. He's where he belongs. He is given the hero's welcome he's always dreamed of. He's even, you know, you can stay here with us. You are among the gods now. But Herc wants to be with Meg on Earth. And Zeus gives his blessing, removes his godhood, and they get to be happy. Again, if you know what actually happens in the mythology.
Yeah, we hope they get to be happy. Yeah, yeah.
Couple of kids, maybe. But yeah. Hera likes Hercules in this version, so maybe everything will be okay.
Yeah, maybe we've removed that portion of the story entirely.
Which leads us to our big final song, A Star is Born. Let's hear it from the mountaintop. They pour one out for Herc. Meg and Pegasus headbutt, and now they're friends. That headbutt again. And Phil gets to make out with Aphrodite.
Yeah, I mean, go Phil. And she initiates it. This is the one time where Phil is not being a lecher. Like, Aphrodite is very into it.
It's Aphrodite. She's the god of love.
And, you know, we get the new star formation.
Yeah. They all return to Thebes. You know, Zeus forms Hercules' image in the stars, immortalizes him in the stars. And, you know, they say, you know, that's Phil's boy. And Phil gets that big tears in his eyes. He finally gets his wish.
Yeah, he gets the one thing that he really wanted, yeah.
So everyone gets a happy ending. A star is born. And the song even continues into the end credits. Which, again, that's not normal for these Disney movies. That the song keeps playing even through the credits. At least the first part of the credits.
Yeah. I did notice that as well. That I can't really think of another Disney film that happens in. That the lyrical part of the song continues into the credits.
And where we started with that same, with a different vibe, but with the image of Hercules, and now with the images of the muses added to it.
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing is that Zeus kind of makes a big thing throughout the entire movie of, like, you know, I can't tell you what it takes to be a true hero. But in the end, it was very obvious what it took to be a true hero.
Yeah, a hero is not measured by his strength, but the strength in his heart.
Well, but that's not really... I mean, it's a very vague way of putting what I think the actual moral of the movie is. And I think I'm going to bring one of my other geeky loves into this and paraphrase from Babylon 5. Which is, you know, how do you know the real heroes, the real chosen ones? It's not the person that does it for fame or glory or for a cause. It's one person willing to lay down their life alone in the dark, unremarked, you know, for one other person. And that's what Hercules eventually did. He's alone in the underworld. There is no crowd to cheer him. No one is ever going to know he made this trade except for Meg. And he's still willing to do it. You know, no Air Herc endorsement, no action figures,
no soft
great
drinks.
Stories. Yeah, no songs, no stories. Just one person that he's willing to lay down his life for no other reason, you know, other than love and that it's the right thing to do. I think that idea of selflessness needs to is one of the best morals that Disney's ever tried to teach. We talked a little bit about it in Lion King as well, of that, you know, Simba had to learn that you don't do this because you want glory and you want people to treat you nice. You do it because it's a responsibility and it's the right thing to do. And exact same thing with Hercules, except, honestly, I think that this is a better story. You know, because Hercules wasn't, he didn't know that this was the thing that was going to get him his godhood, even if he succeeded, you know? He is not thinking of that anymore. All he knows is that there's one person in trouble, and he's going to save her, even if it costs him his life. Mm-hmm. Which I think, on its own, is a much better moral than Lion King. Even though it's very similar. Unfortunately, the movie surrounding that moral was not worthy of that moral, I think.
Yeah, that's where that's kind of where we go to our thing. Does this movie hold up? And it's 290s to hold up. It's still a good.
You know, we kind of poo-pooed last week's film with Pocahontas. That was our first one. That it's not a good movie. This is even worse to me. It's not as offensive to me, I think, in some respects, as Pocahontas. But as a film construction, everything about this is worse to me. The music is worse to me. The animation. I absolutely dislike the animation in this movie. There are a couple of beautiful shots, but the way they drew the characters just feels wrong to me.
The style that they decided to use for this.
It's going to sound weird because it's an animated movie anyway, but the only way I can think to describe it is cartoony in the worst possible way. This is a very cartoony movie. It's not beautiful. I wouldn't want, like, a cell of this hanging on my wall. You know, I don't go like, ooh, the background paintings in Hercules, that's some beautiful imagery. It just, nothing about the visual style of this film appealed to me. You know, too over the top. As much as I love almost all of the stunt-casted actors, you know, I loved Rip Torn, Bobcat Goldthwait, Matt Frewer was, and still is, my jammy jam. Love him. You know, so many of them, these are good casting choices, and for the most part, they're all completely competently and sometimes even more than competently acted, but the script let them down, the jokes let them down, the tone of the movie let them down, and it's really sad to me that there's this excellent moral. There is one of the best characters in a Disney movie ever in Meg. I mean, I really, really love Meg, and I wish she had been in a better movie.
I think that, again, they've tried really hard to make this movie a comedy. I usually watch the original trailer before we started recording, and they straight up say that this is, you know, a comedy adventure. And it's like, I think that was their big mistake, is making this movie full, or trying to make this movie full on comedy.
But
especially with, you know, the overabundance of pop culture references, this is...
But, you know, they did do other... I mean, Aladdin was a straight-up comedy. I mean, there are some, you know, kind of dramatic scenes in there and some action scenes and whatever, but Aladdin is primarily a comedy and was developed to be that just as much as Hercules was.
I don't know. It's like...
But it works in one, and it just absolutely fails in the other on almost the exact same points. It's very strange. Pop culture references in Aladdin, brilliant. Yeah. Pop culture references in Hercules, awful. You know, the kind of drawing from a 40s comedy delivery style works beautifully in Aladdin, does not work at all in this movie. It's just so weird that this is almost the exact opposite, where one succeeded so beautifully and legendarily, and one of them is just such a massive flop. And I don't know what the missing magic ingredient was. It feels to me like this movie could have worked.
And the thing is, it's the same director.
Yeah! It's most of the same kind of creatives behind it.
Yeah, we don't usually go with about the directors, but Ron Clements, John Musker, they did Little Mermaid, they did Aladdin, and they did Hercules.
Yeah, I don't know. It seemed like everybody was doing their best to bring their A game, and they still just absolutely fumbled this in the worst possible way.
Maybe it's a burnout issue, you know, I don't know. Also with the critics, I mean, it's like, this is the tail end of the Disney Renaissance, where people are kind of getting fed up with it. They love the originals. It's like, by the time we get to Pocahontas, everyone starts, you know, kind of dismissing it.
Yeah, I wanted to blame the kind of relatively failure. I'm not sure you can ever call any Disney movie a failure, because they're all going to make their money back anyway, and that's really the one metric that counts. But this was not a well-liked film at the time. It's not a well-liked film now. Like, Hunchback was not a well-liked film when it came out, but now it's considered like a jewel in the crown of Disney, you know, that people now realize what a good movie that was.
Hidden gem, I believe.
Yeah. But Hercules is absolutely still just, you know, it's never, nobody looks back kindly on this film. I don't think.
Yeah. You don't see the characters running around the, you know, the parks anymore.
Yeah. With the exception of Meg, you know,
even that Meg is a very rare character to see.
Well, yeah, and I think Meg is much more liked among the fan base. Like you said, you see a lot of cosplayers and stuff at conventions dressed as Meg. You do not usually see them accompanied by a Hercules.
Even in the parks, like, they'll bring back, like, the two characters they usually bring back are Meg and Hades. And their dynamic. And it works because, again, the way their dynamic is in the film and the way James Woods is acting as Hercules, Susan Egg is acting as Megara, really gets you. I mean, they really are the two best characters in this film.
Yeah. Interestingly, though, is, like you said earlier, Disney is desperately trying to do this as a theatrical musical, just like they've done with a lot of their other ones. They announced it last year.
Mm-hmm.
But they're doing this as a very limited run. This is not being done as like a huge Broadway thing. This is going to be, the plan is that it will be done
similar to Hunchback, where it's sold to like schools and whatnot.
Okay, here's the thing. You wanna know how bad this of an idea this was as a musical. This has already come out.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that?
I did not.
I just saw that. I was reading this as like, they've announced that they're going to do a musical. They must be leading up to it. No, they announced it in February last year. They did it in August and September of last year. We even missed this for our Things Disney Did in 2019 review.
Yeah.
That's how badly this was received, apparently. It was done as part of Shakespeare in the Park for just a couple of, you know, like 2 weeks or something. August 31st until September 8th, so not even. And it had a good cast, including Roger Bart, who played Hades.
Oh, that's perfect.
And we just talked about how much we love Roger Bart and his career and all this kind of stuff. This was not even on our radar that this happened. That's how badly this went down. Oh, man. That blows my mind. Everything that we did for that. Because I had seen, like you did, that they were talking about, like, oh, they're going to do a musical. I'm thinking, like, oh, they've just announced this. They're going to premiere this off-Broadway sometime. No. It's done and gone, and it apparently flopped bad enough that they're just going to forget about it. The Disney fans who do the Disney podcast totally missed this one. That's impressive.
I could see them, like, similar to what they do with Hunchback, where they sell it to, like, schools and community theater to do. But, this is not going to Broadway.
Yeah, and boy, they added a lot of songs to this. They've got a song list, and they've put the songs from the original movie in bold here, and hold on. There are 14 new songs. Some of them are kind of reprises of,
yeah, I see
of
a couple
things. But 14 musical bits that weren't in the original movie.
It's an opera or something?
Yeah, that's way more music than most like Broadway style musicals have. Yeah, so they must have done this as almost entirely an operetta kind of idea. That is fascinating to me. I'm sorry, that just absolutely floored me that they released a new Disney musical, and I did not even realize it. Wow. Okay, that's... Yeah, Disney's Hercules. Big thumbs down from me. I mean, Meg gets a thumbs up, her song gets a thumbs up, the moral that they tried to instill gets a thumbs up, everything else about it is a big ol' flop to me.
Yeah.
Zero to continuing to be zero. I'm sorry. There's just it's flatline zero on this.
I would give it more of a thumbs in the middle. I'll try to be more kind to it, but it's like this is not. If this is your favorite Disney movie, again, you're welcome to love it. We're not gonna hate you for it. But as far as we're concerned, this is on the low end of the Renaissance. This is
absolutely the worst one we've watched so far.
Yeah, and that says a lot.
Yeah.
And considering what could be coming in the future, what other movies are in the Disney catalog.
Yeah, I mean, we may look back more kindly on this after we've suffered through a few other
things. When we're watching Home on the Range, then we'll come back and say we want to see Hercules again.
Yeah, maybe. But for right now, this is absolutely the low point of the rewatch so far. No magic at all in this one, with the exception of Meg, who's almost makes it, yeah.
So now we're almost talking about 3 hours over a movie we didn't like.
As we say, you knew what you were getting into.
let's get down to business. Now we really can do that.
Yeah, I'm much more hopeful for next week. We'll see.
Will we have honor, or will it be dishonor? Because we are going to, again, from Greek mythology to Chinese mythology with Mulan. And we're going to be walking back this, especially with the remake coming in next month.
Yeah.
So we're.
I can't wait to see the remake. So we'll see.
When the remake comes out, we might have to do a special episode comparing the two.
Yeah, there might be a spoiler episode in our near future. So I don't know. Look out for that. Yeah, I'm just going to say that for right now, dishonor on Hercules, dishonor on his cow. Yeah, not a fan. The animated series, though, I cannot recommend enough. I absolutely love Hercules, the animated series. If you remember, if you have fond memories of Hercules that you do not want tainted, skip a rewatch of the movie, because you might be upset that it doesn't hold up the way you remember. But go give Hercules, the animated series, a watch. It is absolutely worth it.
And we were talking about this before we recorded, but there's actually a really good crossover episode as part of the series. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go find it. There is a really... I'm not going to tell you what it is, because I don't want to spoil it, but there is a great crossover episode.
Yeah, and we are probably going to do that one sooner rather than later. We'll see.
Yeah. So considering we've reviewed a bunch of these movies so far, so we can do a crossover.
Yeah.
So join us next week for Mulan. Is there anything else you want to mention?
No, that's it for me. We really do want to thank you for sticking with us so far. And I know that we do have some new listeners that have just recently kind of joined us and or caught up with the series. We love you all. You are wonderful, and you are making this very fun for us. If you want to reach out and talk to us about anything we've said or request anything in the future, like we said, after we get done after we yeet the Renaissance out the nearest window, after we finish doing the entire Renaissance run, we are kind of open to suggestion. If it's in the Disney catalog, and especially if it's on Disney Plus, I think we're up to considering it.
Yes.
So, yeah, let us know if you've got any particular requests, and we will try to work those in.
Yeah, we're putting pretty much everything into consideration. you know, we'll, if you there's a Disney Channel original movie you want us to talk about, we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
You want us to go all the way to the cartoon shows. Yeah.
Original Mickey Mouse shorts. There's a lot of those up on Disney Plus.
We'll talk about the sequels if you want us to.
Yeah. I mean, I might complain a little bit more about that, but, you know, if you want to see us suffer, we will do it for you because we are true heroes.
Do it for the content, man. Do it for the content. So, yes, we've done our heroic duty. We've talked about Hercules. Mulan is next week. We've been talking about this movie way too long, way longer than we should have. So I think it's time to just end it right now. So we will talk to you guys next week. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to Rewatching the Magic. We invite you to keep the magic going by joining the conversation online. Find us on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic, on Twitter at Rewatch the Magic, and of course, find all new episodes at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com. Until next time, remember, the magic is for everyone. It only stops if you let it.